It's 10 months and counting until the start of the nominating season, but that won't stop us from taking an early look at the presidential field for 2008. Sam Popkin and Zoltan Hajnal are next on The Body Politic. Hello, I'm Michael Bernstein, professor of history and dean of arts and humanities here at the University of California, San Diego. The names, Clinton, Obama, Romney, Giuliani, Edwards, McCain, they're in the news every day as these candidates appear to be in full campaign mode, even though the actual election for president is another year and a half away. With so much attention so early, we decided it was time to go to our own political experts for some insights into this historic race. We lead with Sam Popkin, a professor of political science here at UC San Diego. Sam has worked on polling and strategy for a number of Democratic presidential campaigns and has also served as an election analyst, although not at the same time, for CBS News. Welcome, Sam.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's take a look at the field. We'll start with the Democrats tonight. Hillary Clinton, former First Lady, Senator from New York, went out to an early lead in the polls, but now seems to have a fair amount of competition on her hands.
There's always competition for the front runners. There's always somebody who's going to come in second in the poll. There's always somebody for the people who aren't sure what they think about the leader.
So a sort of a disadvantage to getting out to an early start in a certain sense, stalking a horse for the rest?
You have to get out to an early start, but you also have to try and protect the middle of the road. You want to get out to an early start especially and get the activists in New Hampshire and Iowa signed up, and you want to get the big fundraisers signed up, but you don't want to take positions that are too far to the left as a Democrat or too far to the right as a Republican so that you later can't get back to the center. You want to avoid the Howard Dean problem.
Right. Well, now, of course, Senator Clinton has the charge from Barack Obama, the senator from Illinois. He seemingly came out of nowhere. He's been steadily moving up, although the polls weakened a bit last week, I guess. Is Obama for real? Can he sustain this momentum? What do you think?
Obama's absolutely for real. He's probably the most intelligent, thoughtful, and reasonable of the inexperienced candidates. I mean, when you compare him with Gary Hart, he's miles ahead of Gary Hart in what he can do right out of the gate. But he still is new to one of the toughest, fastest games in the world. And I don't think even Senator Obama understands how much faster the game is going to get in the next year.
As the weeks go by. Now, we just had a recent poll the week of April 9 to 12 that showed there was a gap widening between Senators Clinton and Obama. What do you make of those data?
It depends on who's been where doing what. And it's going to go up and down with Senator Clinton's positions on the war, Senator Obama's flubs on things he hasn't thought about yet, the little fights. The essential fact is the two of them have both established themselves with the activists who are paying attention, with the people who donate regularly to political parties, and so has John Edwards. I don't think we can leave out Edwards, because if Obama and Clinton really get into a hissing contest, then the third person can win.
Let's talk about Edwards for a minute, former senator from North Carolina, the vice presidential candidate with John Kerry in the failed 2004 campaign. There seemed to be a lot of sentiment for him as he announced. Then, of course, there was the news of his wife's health struggles. But you see him as possibly having an opportunity here with the two big shots slugging it out.
He's done very good work in the last year and a half in particular to make friends with the only unions that have real troops on the ground, the service workers. He put a lot of effort behind the minimum wage referenda, which won in six states. So he's positioning himself as the poor man's candidate, the little person, even more really than Senator Obama.
Basically, he's taken the left side of the equation, at least in the current conversation.
On health care, he's come out with the most comprehensive plan. On minimum wage, he's doing things quite well. If it weren't for the security issues, I think he'd be a much more serious candidate.
Then we have, in a way, we could call them the second-tier candidates. What about Joe Biden of Delaware? Seems to always be lurking in the shadows when it's nominating time.
You know, John McCain once said, all 100 senators think they could be president because they're one step away, and they talk with the president and realize, I could do that.
Right.
And some of these men really know something better than anybody else in the Senate, like Biden or Dodd or Orrin Hatch for a few weeks recently in one of the campaigns of the last decade. And they thought, why not? It's the end of my career. I might as well give it a shot. And I think, especially in the case of Biden, he figures, I'm the one who knows foreign policy better than all the others. How dare the American people...
Well, he does have a lot of visibility on the international issues compared to these other runners.
But we're not electing a Secretary of State.
Right.
The thing is, all of these men are senators. And all of these candidates we've mentioned so far, Senator Clinton, all the others, that's a real problem because they've been part of so many deals, compromises, and bargains, which is what you really do in government. And usually... you have a real advantage being a governor, like Bill Richardson.
Well, the Democrats elect governors, right? Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, they elect governors.
So do the Republicans.
Yes.
Bush.
George Bush, that's right.
Reagan.
So there's an advantage to coming out of state houses rather than coming out of Capitol
Hill.
There's
a double advantage. Number one, governors actually are executives who know how to manage something. Number two, senators have their fingerprints over every compromise. All legislation is a compromise. Therefore, no senator is pure.
Right. But one more individual to mention, I think, on the Democratic side. Bill Richardson, a kind of interesting figure, governor of New Mexico. How does he factor here? Has a lot of foreign policy experience, ambassador to the UN under the Clinton administration. Was very active in
Secretary
Korean
of Energy.
Secretary of Energy. And a Westerner, which raises an interesting issue.
I don't
here.
Think that the matters is... also Hispanic.
Yes.
And a former
Latino heritage. That's right.
It's not, I would bet on Richardson over Dodd, Biden, Lieberman, and all the other second-tier candidates. But when you don't really have a public reputation early, it's very hard to get started and make a case that you're better at something.
Let's go to the other side of the aisle. Let's talk about the Republicans now. Conventional wisdom, John McCain, senator from Arizona, you know, was the clear favorite here. Now Rudy Giuliani, former mayor of New York City, making a big charge. Where do you see these two men sizing up in this race?
I've been betting heavily against Senator McCain all year.
Because?
Number one, he's really a lot older than he was in 2000. He's 7 years older, by
right.
definition, than he was in 2000. And no matter how much he can be the jocular great guy for part of a day, he doesn't have that zing right now. And I think part of it is trying to be a consistent, straight-line Republican instead of a maverick is taking a toll. And then there's the terrible situation he's in. He's 100% for a good resolution in Iraq and has argued that only more troops gives us a good resolution, but has not looked like he has a feel for the war itself. When he said just the other day, I have no plan B, or when he went to the market and said, with helicopters and guards, it seems very nice.
Right, right. He's taken a pretty strong position right now.
He could well be right on Iraq, but there's one thing to be right, and there's another thing to be really credible.
Right. Giuliani really been storming along here, and right now is leading in the polls.
Giuliani is leading in the polls. What that really tells us is that a very large number of Republicans want a national, non-Southern candidate without such close attachments to some of the Southern slash Bush slash religious positions.
The very conservative social positions.
Giuliani is a tough, moderate Republican. I mean, he's a tough guy, and he's a moderate.
Northeast, former federal prosecutor.
And it tells you a lot.
Big record from September 11.
But people, I think, are in love with the Giuliani of 911. Right. I think this is a perfect example of you fall in love with the personal ad before you've really seen more of the person. And I've always said this is about management, not charisma. And I don't think Giuliani has what it necessarily takes
to
learn.
He may not have legs. I'm
betting on Mitt Romney.
Yeah, that was my next question. Another governor in the mix, Mitt Romney of Massachusetts.
A very flexible other governor in the mix. Somebody who ran the Olympics, who made a fortune founding the Bain Consulting Group. And I would almost bet anything that unless he really tanks, he ends up on the ticket, one of the two positions, because the name Romney is still, Romney is to Michigan as Kennedy is to Massachusetts. Right. The name Romney on the ballot means the Republicans have a phenomenal chance
to
take Michigan. They love the father.
Let's talk about, again, the second tier on the Republican side. Sam Brownback of Kansas, Senator from Kansas, Chuck Hagel, the Nebraska senator. Anything there? Then we have a few others.
Senator Hagel almost got the vice presidential nomination in 2000. It was Ridge versus Hagel, and they couldn't decide whether you wanted the pro-life Hagel or the pro-choice Ridge, and they went to Cheney because his pro-life position was on page 5 of his bio,
right,
and it sort of buried the issue.
Buried, right.
I think Hagel is extremely competent, but he doesn't have that edge to get a campaign going with people. Giuliani somehow had this public name, and you have to have a public reputation that electrifies people and attracts people.
And he works a crowd well. Then we have the Thompsons. You mentioned Fred Thompson.
Tommy
Thompson of Wisconsin.
Fred Thompson has a chance because he has that certain corn. He's cultivated an incredible persona.
Right. He's got a lot of face recognition thanks to his television and movie career.
And he's got a lot of good articulate starting positions. We don't know if he it takes a lot more depth than people understand to give easy sound bites throughout a campaign.
Right.
Because there's always a second question.
Right.
And I don't think people understand how much work it takes to talk about 30 issues in 30 days with 30 reporters.
Well, we also have to ask, since we're here in San Diego, of our local candidate, Duncan Hunter. Anything there?
You asked me earlier about why are all these senators running? Duncan Hunter is one of the most competent congressmen in the country. I don't like his policies necessarily,
right,
but there are
a long career.
You don't get to be head of the Armed Services Committee without extraordinary competence. And all these guys who are better than anybody else in the world at one thing say, I'm better at this than anybody else in the world. I could do president too.
Right.
And there's hundreds of these people in Washington, and some of them say, my career is over. This is my only last hurrah.
Right. Well, let's talk about money for a minute. You've alluded to it a few times. The candidates have reported their campaign contributions for the first quarter. Hillary Clinton, of course, has raised an enormous amount of money, I think about $26 million. But Obama's close, just a few million away from her number, and he has a large number of contributors. Mitt Romney is the leader on the Republican side. How do you see the money dynamics playing out? And this is the lifeblood of the campaign.
Well,
right? This is the determining factor.
So far, by the way, and people think it's a few people giving us money. So far, 300,000 people have given to the top six candidates in the two parties. The really interesting thing is that there are far more people giving to Democrats than Republicans. And that says something about, at this point, the Republicans are less certain that they've got a candidate because they're in a hole and they're looking for, excuse the expression, a messiah. And the Democrats are more confident that somebody good can win.
Well, you've been writing recently about your perceptions of where this race may go. So let's look down the road. How do you see this shaping up in the presidential year? Will the Democrats capture the White House, as at the moment many people seem to think they will?
I think that it's going to be much, much closer than people realize. Number one, whenever a party captures the House or the Senate in the midterm, they now get a share of the blame for the mess.
So it's a blessing and a curse. The Democrats are in control now, but you know, they pay the price.
When the Democrats control Congress, the crazies on the right are 100% out of business. The crazies on the left can now hijack legislation or demand things that the public doesn't like. There's no more pork for Tom DeLay's pet projects, but there's now lots of pork to go to Democrats' pet projects. And the president vetoes, when the president will get more and more moderate looking as he vetoes things. And there's a game. Does he veto things like stem cells the public loves, or does he veto things like tax increases they may not love?
Right.
And if the Republicans nominate a governor and the Democrats nominate a senator, then a Republican governor can be as much the person in shining armor as any Democrat riding to the rescue. So it, you have to give the Democrats an edge because the Republicans are failing on their central theme of A, morality, and B, security.
Let's talk a little bit about the key issues then that obviously, well, at the moment, would appear to be framing the campaign between now and Election Day. Iraq. How do you see that? It'll continue to be an Achilles heel for the Republicans and their president? Or will the Democrats fumble the ball and not be able to demonstrate that they're strong on this issue, as the electorate seems to want?
The public is fed up enough and short-term thinking enough so the Democrats, by pulling plugs, can't get into very much trouble in Iraq. But
do you see the sentiment against the war being strong enough in that sense, the Democrats are in a win-win?
The problem Senator McCain is having is the Republican problem of saying, if we don't do this, it'll be even worse. Now, if the even worse happens, let's say Saudi Arabia goes up, or you know, something happens in Saudi Arabia, or the Taliban plant their flag in Kabul, or President Bashar.
That will play to the Republicans'
Republicans' cards. Well, I don't know. It could just be that they've done it so badly that it plays to them. But what it could do was really help somebody like a Bill Richardson or a Chuck Hagel.
The diplomatic card. Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's got that military edge.
Right.
I mean, if things get bad, you heard it here first, James Webb will be the Democratic vice presidential nominee.
looking to home, health care, pensions, the credit crisis in homeowners' markets and so forth seem to be setting up for a perfect storm in the financial world. Will this play a big role?
I think the big part is going to be health care. And I think the fact that Mitt Romney is a Republican New England governor who signed a health plan, whether it works or not,
right.
I am not about to judge whether it's a good plan or a bad plan,
right.
But a Republican who says there's a Republican way to have health care is a way of saying,
this
I'm doing it for you, not for the poor.
The Commonwealth of Massachusetts passed a mandatory plan, a sort of analogous to what's now going to be debated in California.
And our governor.
Governor Schwarzenegger.
You want to know where the center of the universe is, follow our governor, because nobody has been better at finding this sweet spot between right and left than the one governor who got into the office through the recall.
Well, we have a minute left. You mentioned the stem cell issue. The Senate passed a bill earlier this month that would have expanded federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, but the bill passed just shy of the two-thirds majority needed to make it veto-proof in president. I mean, this has become a symbol of some of the culture wars and some of the social struggles that all candidates have to deal with now. How do you see this shaping up for the 2008
I don't
candidates?
Think people really understand how big stem cells and Terri Schiavo were in cracking the Republican hegemony in the last 4 years and how disillusioned it got. I like to point to Missouri, where Republicans put on the ballot a measure that said, anything you can do nationally, you can do in Missouri. And it was, I like to think of it, it was Danforth versus Ashcroft.
Right.
Senator Danforth, the Episcopalian minister and UN ambassador, and all the science and business, Republican businessmen were for the measure, and the more fundamentalist Republicans were against it. It barely passed, but it passed. And this is a very serious split for the Republicans, between Republicans who believe that stem cells are consistent with the Bible,
right,
and people who believe stem cells are not.
Well, Sam, thanks so much. Always a pleasure with you. A really interesting presidential year sizing up for us. Next up, white attitudes toward black candidates. We're back now with Zoltan Heinl, an assistant professor of political science at UC San Diego. His new book, Changing White Attitudes Toward Black Political Leadership, was just published in December. Zoltan, welcome. And I have to say, you've got a knack for timing.
Pure dumb luck.
Before we talk about Barack Obama, tell me first about the research in this study. You studied voting patterns in Los Angeles and Chicago, right?
Yeah, I looked basically broadly at the effects of black leadership or experience under largely black mayors and its effects on white political behavior, so their attitudes towards blacks and whether or not they were willing to vote for black candidates.
Well, now, how did you measure these attitudes?
There are all kinds of different indicators I looked at. So beyond the vote and what people were doing in the vote, I looked at public opinion surveys. So various different questions about black leadership, about the black community as a whole. Things like, are blacks pushing too hard? Do they deserve special favors, and so on and down the line. So they're very basic, generic indicators of racial attitudes. And the goal was to see whether attitudes changed more for whites who were living under black leaders than they were for whites who were living elsewhere.
And your key findings?
Key findings are that there's actually a fair amount of positive change among the white community, or at least among certain segments of the white community under black leadership. So there's
A positive perception of these leaders, and the
story is that before African Americans are elected to positions of leadership for the first time, so the first black mayor of a city like Chicago, there's a certain amount of fear and apprehension about what will happen. Will blacks redistribute resources to blacks, taking away from whites? Will there be white flight, and so on and so forth? In the end, black leadership doesn't lead to any of these. The worst fears of whites aren't realized. And for at least some white residents of these cities, they are sort of forced to sit back and say, well, blacks could have hurt us, and they didn't. I'm now, I think, less fearful of the next black candidate who might come along. There may be some reconsideration of whether white interests are that diametrically opposed to black interests.
And so these mayors generally then were perceived as, I mean, if there weren't agreement across all issues, presumably they were perceived as responsible and forwarding the interests of the city.
And the hurdle is not that high. They just need to be better than the worst fears of many white residents. So as long as they do a reasonably good job. Now, there may be some exceptions, like Washington, D.C., where the black mayor comes into office and does a horrendously poor job. But in general, they did reasonably well. And the white community was as well off after.
One obvious question, given that you studied Los Angeles and Chicago, would be, what about the South?
Right.
I mean, you alluded to Washington, D.C., a kind of border city,
right,
if you will. But what about attitudes about black political leadership in the South?
Right. I mean, attitudes generally are worse in the South, although I tend to believe it's less about the South itself, per se, and more about the size of the black community. So in all these elections that I looked at, the white vote was closely tied to the size of the black community. So the larger the black community, the more of a threat of blacks actually taking over, and the greater the white opposition. So there was generally more opposition in the South, but a lot of it was due to the fact that you have larger black populations in many of these cities.
There does seem to be an interesting message in this research about, if you will, integration generally, that experience between groups, as you say, experience in this case of African-American political leaders in positions of power and authority, actually does make for social change.
And I think the key is in positions of authority. So the perception is they could have made things a lot worse and they didn't, and so I'm going to learn something from that. If African-Americans are co-workers or in a sort of subordinate position, there may be all kinds of reasons for them not living up to the stereotypes. So those actions in those cases can be discounted. It's harder to discount African-American leaders.
Looking nationally, I mean, your study, of course, two major cities, Los Angeles and Chicago, but you feel these are generalizable results to the national electorate?
Sure, and actually, in addition to the sort of the core case studies of Los Angeles and Chicago, I did analysis of every large city that had has had an African-American mayor, and then this larger national public opinion data where we're comparing all cities with black mayors or some sample of those to sample of the white population elsewhere. So it does appear to be generalizable, with the caveat is that some places have a much stronger learning process and greater effects, and other places less so. But on average, a positive effect.
And did you test for or see any generalizable results about issues, particular issues that did or did not cultivate changes in attitudes?
What I did see in terms of white voting behavior is that the racialization of the black candidates' campaign mattered a lot. So to the extent they focused on race-specific black issues, they lost white support. And this occurred not only in the first elections, but in more recent elections when incumbents were running. So early on, elections tended to be just about race. Now, this racialization matters, but other things like campaign endorsements, the experience of the candidates, these recent elections with black mayors are more normal than they were previously.
Right. We did open mentioning Barack Obama, so let's go there with the time we have left. How do you perceive his, you know, historic candidacy in this race affecting the national dialogue on race, national perceptions, even voting patterns?
Well, I mean, my take is that the big impact will be is if he's elected. So his candidacy in itself will make us talk about race a lot. I don't know if it will change perceptions, but if he ultimately is elected, I think an African-American holding that position of sort of incredible leadership and assuming he does a reasonably good job of it would potentially change a lot of people's attitudes about African-Americans.
Is it, in your view, necessary that he be elected or be on the ticket? I mean,
I think elected is really critical, because then he has the power to harm different segments of the community, has the power to change policy, and to the extent that he's even-handed, that will, I think, show certain people who may be on the fence about race that there may be commonalities that they hadn't thought of before. We've had this transformation over time from the 60s to today, where race in the 1960s was incredibly consequential, and the vast majority of whites would vote against these first-time black candidates, and turnout would be remarkable, almost record turnout in all the cities that I look at. Fast forward to the 1990s, new black challengers face much less white opposition. Turnout drops to near normal levels. So the
electorate's getting used to it.
Right. Yeah. So there is learning that's occurring over time. And so in the case of Obama, you would think that race would be much less consequential than it has been earlier in the past. Now, I still think race matters, and the big question is how much does it matter?
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Zoltan, very much. Zoltan Hainal's new book, Changing White Attitudes Toward Black Political Leadership, is now available on Amazon.com. And that's it for tonight's show. Thank you for joining us on The Body Politic. I'm Michael Bernstein. Good night.